14. This is the Hermetic Hour, and I'm your host, Pope Runyon. And tonight we present a discussion on ancient and modern multiverse concepts in relation to Hermetic magic, the Kabbalah, astrology, and Fortean phenomenon. Now we will examine philosophical, scientific, literary, and cinematic models of the multiverse, sometimes called the holographic universe or parallel worlds. We will trace the idea through the nesting spheres of the geocentric age to the heliocentric renaissance, the invention of the telescope and the discovery of other galaxies and antimatter, both in terms of science and the pages of science fiction. Our references will be Mary Jane Rubinstein's Worlds Without End, and Michio Kaku's Parallel Worlds, the science fiction of Philip K. Dick and Richard S. Shaver, and films such as The Matrix, Dark City, and Lost Highway. Our challenge will be to reconcile ancient Hermetic philosophy with the multiverse concept. So, if you want to go through the looking glass or down the rabbit hole, tune in and we will tour the endless mouths of the simultane. Well, as you can imagine, this is a rather deep subject. And we'll get deeply into it, but we'll try not to lose you. Although I must admit, as I started into Mary Jane Rubinstein's Worlds Without End, for a while there I was kind of lost, and finally I think I got accustomed to it and began to really kind of relate to it. This is a mind-bending subject, and it's been a mind-bending subject for the past 2,500 years. It's been a mind-bending subject. And there are a number of philosophers and religious figures and magicians and people who have helped to make it a mind-bending subject. But finally, after all of these speculations and ramifications on this issue, finally, it is acquiring some very astute scientific possibilities, and that it has become scientific theory as well as theories of mystical philosophy and theories of literary devices. It now has received scientific credence. So let's first define just what the multiverse is and what it's not. There's not much that it's not, and there is quite a bit that it is. What it amounts to is this: the multiverse, or the holographic universe, or parallel worlds, the way it is now, it wasn't always this way, but the way it is now, it's a series of other dimensions. According to string theory, there may be 11 of them, and of course that fits with the Kabbalah nicely, but then it also might be endless. It could be endless. But what they are other dimensions that are either separated from us by an impossible distance, or separated from us by, or they're separated from us, but they are almost coexistent with us. And this particular concept is difficult to grasp. It's difficult to wrap your mind around it. But it has been speculated and postulated and speculated upon for a long, long time, and now it appears that it may very well be really operative. And the reason why we now think it may be operative is the discovery of a substance called dark matter. In essence, what we're talking about is the universe that we can detect, the universe that we can detect and measure through all our various measuring devices and systems, has a very, very, very large percentage of its matter is missing. And that what that you know, it's missing. It's not there. It's just we can't detect it. This applies to weight. It applies to spectral analysis. It applies to just about any aspect of the measuring scale that you can come up with. Almost 50% in some areas is of the universe is beyond our detection. Where is it? And it seems the most logical answer is it's in other dimensions. You might want to think about this like I like to keep thinking about it like a little boy blowing soap bubbles. And each one of these soap bubbles he blows is a different universe. And there's no way you can get from one soap bubble to another without breaking the soap bubble. I mean, this is and all these soap bubbles are floating around now. Now, you know, you might say that the little boy is God, all right, if you want to say that. And so this one little boy with his little bottle of soap, liquid soap, and his little hoop that he uses, he is sort of like God, creating all these multiverses and these different little universes. Now that's one way of looking at it, but then there's also the very strong possibility that all of these different universes are all interpenetrating each other, and we can't detect them, we can't reach them, but they're passing right through us. So it's possible that from a spatial standpoint, that you could, if you could walk through the wall, you might come out on the other side, and you'd be in another very close version of your universe. You wouldn't really know whether you were in it or not. We thought, people speculated, of course, that we have aspects of penetration. So we'll get into that. We'll get into the various ideas of how we can reach the different dimensions, and if they can be reached, and all of that as we get into it. But first, let's start out and using Mary Jane Rubenstein's very good book, by the way. But as I say, it's you need to have a little bit of philosophy and a little bit of Mishu Kaku is under your belt before you try this one, frankly. In the book, by the way, that I'm referring to is Worlds Without End, The Many Lives of the Multiverse, and it's Columbia University Press. Mary Jane Rubenstein is the author, and it's copyright 2014. Now, according to what Mary Jane is developing here, is that this concept of a multiverse was actually started by the Epicurean philosophers and a little bit before Plato and Aristotle and the atomists. The atomists really conceived of atomic theory before anybody had any idea what. Before they came up with this, people just assumed that we were pretty solid, except they knew we had a lot of liquid in us, but I mean, we were solid, and the rocks were solid, and the rest of it, everything was pretty solid. But the atomists, they conceived the idea of atoms, and I think they jumped right to atoms and bypassed molecules, but somebody said once that Greek philosophers at one time or another have imagined everything possible. And the impossible can possibly be imagined. But these atomists were very, very much ahead of their time. And they thought, they conceived of these multiple worlds. And then Plato came along. And Plato, as we all know, was a closet Pythagorean. In fact, he was so much of a Pythagorean, he even He even spent about 10 years over in Italy trying to dig up everything he could on Pythagoras. But Plato wrote a dialogue called the Timaeus, which was essentially Pythagorean, and it described the cosmos as, you know, and it was a sort of the epitome of Pythagorean cosmic conception at the time of Plato's flourishing. And in the Timaeus, he pretty much replicated and amplified on a Pythagorean universe, which involved, of course, the music of the spheres and astrology in those days they thought the fixed stars were fixed. I mean, literally, they really were fixed. I mean, there was a band outside of all of the spheres of the planets, and they were all. You know, there wasn't any such thing as an elliptical orbit in those days. They were all kind of a nesting bowl kind of a universe with the Earth in the center, and then the fixed stars were all of, they weren't necessarily further away from each other. They were all in this sphere, the outer sphere that. Yeah, well, and there was spheres beyond that, but they were all fixed up there, and they didn't move. And the planets, of course, moved around the Earth, including the Sun. And that was their conception, and Plato pretty much went along with that, and Timaeus. But then he opened up speculation on the idea that there might be multiple universes. And he contradicted himself in the beginning, and then he went ahead and said that there could be, and whatever, giving a kind of a bow to the atomists. And yet, when he suggested multiple universes, he was really kind of thinking about the idea of a duplicate, you know, another universe pretty similar to ours. And it wasn't right to that dimensional idea yet, although, if you recall Plato's allegory of the cave, Plato was already, aware and making us aware that what we saw and what we were looking at was really not the way things were. And that we were, if you recall that allegory of the cave, we were in a cave looking at shadows. We're in this dark cave, and there was a light coming in, and it was casting shadows on the wall of the cave, and we really couldn't tell what those shadows were, and yet we thought that that was reality, but really that was a shadow from somewhere else, and so Plato was setting the stage for this idea, which had already been proposed by the atomists, that things were really not the way they seemed, and that we were really what you perceived was very possibly an illusion. And then we got, unfortunately, when Christianity came along, in the Dark Ages, Christianity comes along, and at this point, the Christians have this Trinity doctrine, which we'll get into its implications a little later. Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. We've discussed that on some of our lectures before, and they had to make Plato and Aristotle had to serve this doctrine. Well, okay, Aristotle served it better than Plato as far as the Christians are concerned, because Aristotle took a very mechanical and a very practical and a down to earth, if you want to use that expression, view of things, and that was comfortable for the Christians to adopt that. And yet at the same time, Christian philosophers were really, really romancing themselves with Plato. And also, they were beginning to, and they were doing this, once they had their Christian revolution fully established, they could they could disenchant themselves from their anti-intellectual bully boys that they sent around to tear down all the pagan temples and beat people up if they didn't bow down to Jesus and whatever. Once they had a solid grip on state religion, able to begin to entertain Plato. They didn't want the masses so much to know this, but what they wanted to do was to transform Jesus from a Middle Eastern prophet, and they wanted to transform him into a Western sun god. They did this very, very, very astutely, but in doing this, of course, they began to usher in the ideas of the old Hermetic universe. And they began to kind of entertain this. So what happened? But they still had to. They still absolutely they had to defend this Trinity doctrine. And this is important because there is a great deal in Jesus's philosophy in the teachings of Jesus. There is a great deal of support for the multiverse. And for the Hermetic structure, and the central idea of Hermetism, as I'm sure those of you who followed our lecture program, you know this, the main idea in Hermetic Enlightenment is that everybody has a divine spark of God, and everybody is at the center of his own universe. Now, this is the school that Jesus is coming out of, is this form of Hermetic Gnosticism, this is and Neoplatonism that Jesus is actually coming out of. And the only difference between Jesus and this only central difference between Jesus and Hermes is that Jesus could not. He wanted to give salvation. He wanted to give this kind of enlightenment to the common people, but he couldn't do it. The common people couldn't handle it. And so, you know, when Jesus says things like, "In my Father's house are many mansions. I go to prepare a place for you. If it were not so, I would not have told you." Well, what's he mean by that? In my Father's house are many mansions. Well, he's talking about the multiverse and the endless multiverse. Because according to his philosophy and Hermetic philosophy, you're at the center of an endless, endless universe. Each one of us is at the center. Each one of us has just as much God inside us as everybody else. Now, Jesus could not get this, he knew he couldn't get this across to the common people. And the best example of this, I think, most of you, I think, have seen The Life of Brian at one time or another, Monty Python's Life of Brian. Well, you know, Brian is out there preaching to the multitude in Palestine, and he's preaching to them, and he says to them, "God is within you." And they all cheer, and they all say, "Brian has put God within us. He's given us God." And then Brian says, no, that's not what I meant. You're all born with God in you. You got just as much God in you as I have." And then they all cheer, and they say, "See, Brian has given us God. Brian has put us in touch with God." And so poor Brian, he can't explain it to them. He just can't. So Brian never did manage to explain it to him. But Jesus decided, I think even before he started his ministry, he decided that, no, I'm not going to try to. But he told his disciples. He told his disciples the real secret. And said that you will do greater miracles than I. So actually, this vast personal universe or multiverse concept is really is Christian and is also Hermetic. Unfortunately, in the Middle Ages, the church was, oh boy, you don't want to get into this. I mean, they skirted around it. Although, and this is something that I didn't realize this until I read Mary Jane's book, but there was a medieval philosopher, and I'm going to try to see if I can dig him up here, a medieval philosopher who actually did promote this idea and the multiverse, and that that each one of us was at the center of it, and he managed to get away with it, and they even made a cardinal out of him. But fortunately, in those days, common people were not reading, and the only people who were reading his books were other churchmen and scholars, and so they weren't too worried about this. And then, of course, unfortunately, the church had these various counter reactions, and in Italy, where so much of this speculation was going on, these counter reactions were usually generated when the Spanish would take over. They take over Rome or Florence occasionally, and when they do this, they bring in the Spanish Inquisition, and then what you got an imperator for writing last year, all of a sudden gets you burned at the stake. So they were difficult. The speculation was difficult. But the incidents that I want to point out here is that what happened right before Giordano Bruno, there was a Catholic scholar who they made a cardinal out of him, a Catholic scholar by the name of Nicholas Cusa, and just about everything that Bruno ended up with came from Nicholas Cusa. But Nicholas Cusa was, he published, he was very careful in one instance. And that very careful instance was the preserving of the special, exclusive divinity of Christ. See, as long as you can do that, then you could, well, at least in Nicholas Cusa's time, you could, if you did that, you could actually publish, the limited scope that they could publish, you could actually publish, and you might even get an imprimatur on it. But the aspect of this that is important is you must not write anything that's going to challenge the exclusive divinity of Christ. Well, church scholars like Cusa were able to rationalize this by saying, all right, we can justify the exclusive divinity of Christ by saying that all Christians have Christ within them, and therefore we can play a little trick along, you know, a little mental gymnastics. We can do it that way, and then we can still say that Christ is exclusively divine. This is kind of like Brian, Brian trying to get the multitude. Yeah, all right, yes, I gave you God, okay, but now you see. But Cusa was smart enough to do that, and then Bruno that followed along, about 60 years later, something like that. Bruno followed along, and he credited Cusa for a lot of his ideas. But Bruno, oh gosh, Bruno just couldn't. He was very antagonistic, and he could not manage to slip into the exclusive divinity of Christ or to rationalize it. So he said that if the earth revolves around the sun, as Copernicus says it does, and of course I agree with him, and all intelligent people should agree with him, and if that's the case, well, then Jesus isn't God, the sun is. And, of course, the church had been, rather quietly moving around to the idea of making Jesus into a sun god. But they didn't want Bruno saying that no, the sun was God, and Jesus wasn't. And so poor Bruno got burned at the stake. And this, you know, this was, Bruno, it's almost as if Bruno should have had sense enough to do the little gymnastics. But the reason why I'm telling you this story in relation to the multiverse is this. Bruno, boy, was he ever a believer in the multiverse. And the idea here of the multiverse is, and so many of them said this, and it's straight Hermetic philosophy. It even ended up in Albert Pike's 28th degree. It's not in there anymore, but it was. Where you are at the center of the universe, because the universe is endless, absolutely endless, and it has no center. So wherever you are is the center, and your person, you are the center point. And here again, this may sound like spiritual gymnastics, but actually, when you think about it, it's very logical. If the universe has no boundaries, if it goes on forever, then wherever you happen to be, that's the center of it. This concept now came about before we knew about the fixed stars idea. That didn't die until Galileo had the telescope. And when Galileo started, if we had people looking through the telescope, then we began to realize over into the 17th and 18th century, we began to realize, hey, these stars go on. They go on and on and on and on and on. And then imagine what happened when we discovered that all of them are not just stars. Some of them, a lot of them, are galaxies, other galaxies. Just as big or bigger than the Milky Way. And we know, Lord. I mean, so we're faced then with this vast, absolutely inconceivably vast, what literally is a multiverse. But it's a multiverse all in one dimension as far as we can tell, because we're seeing it, see? We're looking out there and we're seeing them. Now, granted, it's virtually inconceivable when you look out into the night sky and realize that many of these little things you're seeing out there are actually other galaxies, and they're trillions of miles away, and the light that we're seeing is millions of years in the past, and all it's staggering. I don't think that there are very many of us really that have fully grasped it, even to this day, even with the Hubble and all of the knowledge that we have. I think there's a lot, many of us, and I find myself in that category. I just to try to imagine how big it is, and are you going to put boundaries on it? Well, we do. We say, okay, there was a Big Bang. There was something before the Big Bang. Well, there had to be something before the Big Bang. Come on. You know, it goes on and on and on. Now, then, the next thing we discovered was this antimatter thing. Like, hey, we're looking out at all these galaxies and all this endless universe here, and, hey, that's just what we can see. There's other dimensions there, and they'll probably go on endlessly, and we can't see them. It's like the old hippie joke, you know. And there's an old hippie joke about the two hippies are down on Santa Monica Pier, and they're kind of stoned, and the one looks out there, and he says, man, that's a lot of water out there. And his buddy says, yeah, and that's only the top. Well, yeah, think about that, because that applies to deep space. Yeah, you're seeing all these galaxies and nebulas and all these magnetic clouds and all this kind of stuff. It goes on and on and on forever. And that's only the top. That's only one dimension. What about all these other dimensions? Yeah. And if you are the center of this universe, you are also the center of all these other universes. Now, one of the points that the physicists debate, and I want to explain it, get into the science fiction aspect of this pretty shortly. And so consequently, we, for a while there, we would talk about other dimensions to our friends who are atomic physicists, and we would kind of suggest that these other dimensions were just very much like our world, and that we could, through the looking glass, and things were a little different, but they were very much like our world. And the other, and the atomic physicists a few years back would look at you and smile and say, oh, come on, you don't know. Another dimension, yeah, that's possible, but it wouldn't be like that. It'd be smaller, it'd be larger, it'd be different, it'd be whatever. Well, now, they're not so, at this point, your atomic physicist friends are, most of them, are not looking down their noses at you when they say that. But then they did. Now, why did they? Why did they look down their noses when we suggested this? Because the science fiction writers had already come up with it. Well, there's a good reason for that. And this is something, by the way, that Mary Jane Rubenstein points out. Our particular universe is very, very delicately balanced physically. And it is so delicately balanced physically that if just one little factor is out of whack, we'd all be dead. We'd all be gone and I don't know how long it takes to be extinct, but we would be. We couldn't. We are so delicately balanced. And everything is, that it almost, this is the argument really for intelligent design, by the way, because our ecology, for instance, the Earth, we couldn't live without the moon. The moon controls the tides and seas and a lot of other things, and the moon's too big anyway. And so how does all this get balanced so we can live? Now, granted, human beings are very adaptive. But if you mess around with our air, the mixture of our air, we're not going to be here very long. And if we try to live on Mars, trying to live on Mars is about like trying to live underwater at the North Pole. Without several thousand dollars worth of protective gear, you're not going to make it for very long. And so how do we, in another dimension, in another world, another world separate from ours. You may be, spatially, it may occupy the same place. But if it's different, if it's so different that we can't contact it, we can't contact it by usual means, but let's say we can't contact it, it's separate from us, it's going to be different ecologically. The scientists would tell you, and you couldn't breathe because the air mixture would be different and all of that. Well, the air mixture would be different, the temperature would be different, a lot of things. So therefore, other life forms would have to exist, not human beings and whatever, and on and on and on. Well, they may be right. They may be right about that, but then we have an answer to that one, too. If this is a holographic universe, and if we are all, if we're all at the center, each one at the center of our particular holographic universe, all right? Now, what that means is that even though in the different levels of what we call the simultaneous, in other words, we call it the simultaneous because it's simultaneous, and all these layers are referred to as different nows, and the whole complex of different nows endlessly from which you are the center is called the simultaneous. Now, we're adopting this terminology from a science fiction writer that conceived of this, Richard Sharp Shaver, and since then it's been used by a number of other scientists. He's the first one to conceive of this, of these layers in this respect. But you can move the only way you can move through the simultaneous is if you have counterparts in the simultaneous, which you would have if you're the center of the universe. And that's according to Hermetic philosophy. And you remember when I said in the abstract at the beginning, our challenge was going to be to take this multiverse and make it relate to Hermetic philosophy, incorporate it into Hermetic philosophy. Well, I have to give our old Phoenician prophet, Jesus of Nazareth, a lot of credit, because I think he had a pretty good handle on it, and even though he he opted out for the divinity thing, but if you just consider that you are the center of the universe, you have to be. How, where else is the center of the universe? Now you're asking, you're saying, okay, well, you got any proof of that? Yeah, I do. Our government spent a lot of money, and I think the Russians probably spent more money, or whatever they had for money in those days, doing experiments in remote viewing. And these experiments were very successful, remarkably successful, which means basically that a remote viewer can get accurate. He can send his consciousness out to anywhere in the world he wants it to go. And if he's well trained and if he's using the right methods, he can tell you exactly what is going on in some other country, in some other location. And that ought to be proof enough right there, which we taxpayers pay for, by the way. That ought to be proof enough right there that, yeah, you are at the center of the universe. You really are, if you operate that way. Well, of course, we don't care. If you don't care, you're not interested. Well, then maybe you're not. But if you realize that, and if you operate accordingly, yes, you are at the center of the universe. So the secret of making the simultaneous work in the Hermetic system is very simply the concept of your counterpart. Now, your counterpart, give it a number. Your counterpart may be 20 layers or 20 nows away. Your counterpart might be green and have four legs, or might have three eyes and one of them in the back of his head, and certainly can't breathe the same air. But he's your counterpart, so you can mentally access him, and he can mentally access you. And this immediately explains so much Freudian phenomenon that just falls into place immediately with this. Now let's talk about a couple of, while we settle on this subject, that we would discuss some literary and cinematic versions of this, so you can get a little better grasp on it. The literary aspect of it, before Schaber in 1949 actually developed the structure and everything else, and I'm not so sure, in his case, Schaber, he was like the ancient Greeks. He imagined all kinds of things. And this happened to be one that he came up with before the rest of them really put the tag on it. But since Schaber came up with that, there have been numerous versions of it. I think Zelazny came up with his Princes of Amber, where it is an interesting concept on this, where there was one world. And he didn't use the simultaneous terminology, but it is essentially the same. There's one world in the simultaneous, the real world, and all the rest of them are divergent reflections. And the real world in Amber has a hierarchy of nobility, and they have their counterparts in other dimensions. And so Amber, the princes of Amber, run the rest of the run their counterparts and chase their counterparts through other layers of the simultane. And this is all set up not in a linear fashion, so that you wonder why are all these things going on. And finally, you find the protagonist finds out that he's a Prince of Amber and all of this. But it's a good example of what we would otherwise call Freudian phenomena, like the UFOs. Jacques Vallée, the top UFO researcher, has been saying for decades that the UFOs are coming from another dimension. And that makes very good sense. It does, because they appear out of nowhere. They operate in such a way that no human being could possibly stand the G-force that they operate in, and they make right angle turns at Mach 4 or something like that, and even our machinery couldn't handle it, much less our people. And so they're probably coming from another dimension. And Jacques Vallée has written several books on that. And so our supernatural phenomena, and here I'm using Freudian terms, I think most of you know Charles Fort ruthlessly collected all this stuff over years and years and years and years and years, and it's overwhelming. It is overwhelming proof that we are not alone in this dimension. In other words, there are other dimensions that where things are coming from and things are reaching us, and perhaps our counterparts and perhaps enemies of our counterparts, perhaps what we do in this slice of the simultaneous influences what happens in the other slice. Consider this too, and Shaver came up with this one. What if you and your counterparts are all at different ages, in different slices of the simultaneous, different nows, you're all at different ages. So you never die. You die in one layer of the simultaneous, but you're just being born in another. Or you're still a teenager, and in one you're going down, the next one you're still going as a teenager. Your consciousness can slip because the mind is not the brain. Now the mind can, as we know, exist outside of the brain. So you could just continue to exist almost without hesitation. You could continue to exist throughout endless layers of the simultaneous. Oh, yeah. Now, as far as navigating the simultaneous is concerned, I have, I don't really have any formula for that because we're not dealing with linear. We're not dealing with a linear track. We're not dealing with, this is even more relative than Einstein. And, in fact, consider that if we could, navigate the simultaneous, then space travel would be very much facilitated. We could go to other galaxies. When we got there, we would be our counterparts. We would be our counterparts, not ourselves, and our counterparts would be greatly removed from us. These are ideas that are a bit mind-bending. But to talk about, we mentioned Shaver, but let's talk about Philip K. Dick, because Philip K. Dick used this concept, and he was very, very, very effective with it. And several films that you've seen have been related to this other dimension. Now, a film called Dark City, a very, very good film, and very much and kind of a Phil Dickian kind of a film, but also very much like the multiverse. And here it has a other dimension, another dimension in which human beings are dominated by an alien race who wants to study them, so they can somehow or other manage to figure out why we are creative and why we are individuals. And Dark City is a very, 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 very interesting film. Another one that relates to the simultaneous as it affects us in everyday life. And this is a film by David Lynch called Lost Highway. Now, in Lost Highway, you have a man and his wife, and mysterious things start happening to them. And what ends up happening is that they have counterparts very close to them. The counterparts are almost identical, and in this other dimension that is right next to them, and they are not sure at various times which dimension they're in. Now, this is also possible, and our friend Ralph Metzner has a very, very fine book on worlds within and worlds without, And in that book, he's very much into Buddhist philosophy. And in that book, Metzner theorizes that, along with Buddhist philosophy, that you may be in these different dimensions, or these Buddhist hells, so to speak, for various times, and you think you're in this dimension and you're not. You could be in actually be in a Buddhist hell while you're still while you still believe you're in this particular universe. You could wake up in another. You go to sleep. Where do you go when you sleep? Well, you know. Where do you go when you dream? L. Ron Hubbard, who did write some very, very good science fiction, he wrote a novel called The Slaves of Sleep, where people lived different lives when they were asleep and had different adventures when they were asleep. And this related, of course, also to their activities in this dimension. So what happens if you wake up one morning and you're in another slice of the simultane and you don't know it? And then you go through the whole day and everything is just slightly different. And then you go home and you go to sleep and you wake up and you're back in the one and you don't even know it. Or strange things happen and you wonder why they do. Okay? So all of this is very possible, and it explains these Fortean and spirit phenomena. Now, that brings up the question, of course, you might say, well, what about schizophrenics? Okay, they're hearing voices in there, and they're having visions of these other dimensions, what have you. Now, we know that schizophrenia is not a disease of the mind, it's a disease of the brain. But that, in turn, that disease, whatever the chemical imbalance is, affects the brain. I mean, it affects the mind. And so, consequently, the schizophrenic could have more of an access to the simultane than the so-called normal person. Well, that would fit pretty well with Shaver, because Shaver was at various times a schizophrenic. I think he kind of outgrew it, but for a while he was... For a while, he was in a lockdown medical asylum and in a coma. And when he was in a coma, he was in this other, this definitely another dimension. And so what we think of up until recently as a literary convenience, because this sort of concept was really great for fiction writers. They could really do, have a grand time with it. But now we're looking at the very strong possibility that this might very well be real, and real and real and real and real and real and really real. And you wonder where in the center of the universe is the simultane that is the real one, and all the rest are reflections. Is that true? Would that be? Could that be? Maybe. Could be. So are you at the really? Are you really at the center of your center? These are questions you could ask yourself. And you could ask yourself these questions, but I would think that this concept would be one that would be exhilarating and exciting. And even though you can't figure it all out and it could be kind of overwhelming, and yet at the same time, what an adventure! What a chance! Here you are right now. Maybe your life is not going the way you like it to, but somewhere else, one of your counterparts is doing a lot better than you are, or a lot worse. And maybe you're getting hints of this in your dreams, and maybe this is something you can access. Yeah, something that will help you, or maybe you can help them, or whatever. Yes, I think that this makes the universe a much more exciting and a much more beautiful place. So I'm not really that terrified by it. I'm exhilarated by it. I think it's a great idea. And show. But I don't claim. I'm not claiming that I can navigate the simultaneity any more than anybody else can. I don't have any. In fact, how do we do it? How do we vector? How do we control the vortex? How do we do all of this? Well, we can experiment. Keep experimenting. And this is one of the reasons why magic, I think, is an endless fascination, because in many ways that's what we're doing. We're exploring the multiverse. Now, next week we are going to have a discussion about what I think is a fascinating subject, and that's the secrets of Sufi Freemasonry. And this is a different version of the temple legend, and a system of the signs of obligation are actually activations of the psychic centers or chakras. There's a lot of very fascinating stuff here, and so next week it's Secrets of Sufi Freemasonry. And meanwhile, don't get lost in the simultane, especially after dark. And we'll see you next week, and good magic.